Hello and welcome to the March 2024 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. Easter last year was on the 9th of April. This year it is earlier and falls on the 31st of March. By the time you listen to this month's Roundabout, we will still be in Lent, so I thought I would share some thoughts on Lent. Lent and the significance of fasting, abstinence, and almsgiving. Lent, the 40 days from Ash Wednesday, excluding Sundays and leading up to Easter, is observed by Christians all over the world. It is a time of reflection, repentance, and spiritual growth. Fasting, abstinence, and almsgiving hold great significance during this time. Each of these practices hold a deeper meaning and plays a crucial role in the spiritual journey of an individual. Fasting, the practice of abstaining from food or certain types of food for a specific period, is a way to discipline our bodies and minds, reminding us that our physical needs should not control us. Fasting during Lent is a way to detach oneself from the materialistic world and focus on one's spiritual needs. It is a time of self-reflection where one learns to appreciate the blessings of food and understand the struggles of the less fortunate. Fasting also helps one to resist temptations and practice self-control in other aspects of one's life. It can be a humbling experience that reminds one of the sacrifice of Jesus and his journey in the desert. Abstinence, on the other hand, is the act of giving up something we enjoy or like to indulge in. It could be a particular food, activity, or habit that we give up for the 40 days of Lent. This practice teaches us to let go of our desires and focus on our spiritual needs. It is a way to purify our hearts and minds and strengthen our willpower. It serves as a reminder of the sacrifices of Jesus and his ultimate sacrifice of death on the cross. Lastly, almsgiving is the act of giving to those in need, whether through donations, volunteering, or acts of kindness. It is a way to show love and compassion towards others and to follow in the footsteps of Jesus, who always showed kindness and generosity to the poor. It is a reminder to be grateful for what one has and to share one's blessings with others. Almsgiving also helps one to detach oneself from material possessions and focus on the more important things in life. Fasting, abstinence, and almsgiving, therefore, are not just mere practices, but they hold a deeper spiritual meaning. They serve as a reminder of the sacrifice of Jesus and his teachings of love, compassion, and selflessness. These practices can help one to grow spiritually and become more mindful of one's actions. They also teach one the importance of self-discipline, gratitude, and kindness towards others. Here is what we have in store for you this month. John Townsend will be in conversation with Josh Meredith. David Picton will be reading his poem entitled Family Ties. Sue Smallwood will be reading her story about A Visit to the House of Marbles. Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor will be discussing a book they have read recently. Ninon Jerome will be reading her story entitled Silver Swans. Fran Frank will be sharing some facts and figures related to a particular location in Devon. Norma Orty will be reading her story entitled Dream Books. We will conclude the program with a piece of music.
Hello, it's John Townsend here again with another of my Performing Arts Devon Dialogues, where I have the privilege of chatting with talented musicians, actors, singers, and theatrical directors who work both locally and further afield. Previously, I have enjoyed talking to performers with long and distinguished careers, but today, and last time with Lucy, I'm pleased to welcome someone just setting out in the world of performing arts. Local Dawlish lad, Josh Meredith, has popped into the studio after his recent tour in Jack and the Beanstalk. So welcome to my own pantomime world, Josh.
Hello.
Before you tell us about your exciting life on the road with a villainous giant and magic beans, let's go back to when you first performed on the stage. Dare I ask, how old were you then and how old now?
Well, when I first started, I think I was 13, and okay. Now I'm 18.
Right, so you've had all those years of
treading the boards.
And we're talking at the Shaftesbury Theatre in Dawlish?
Yes, I was involved with the youth group there.
Yeah, so your first show was?
It was Rats.
Right, were you a rat?
I was a rat.
Okay, were you singing and scurrying? Okay. What did you have to do as a rat?
So I think I was rat free.
Okay.
He was the most intelligent rat out of the lot.
Of course.
Yes, I know. Gosh, the brain's on me, eh? No, as rat free, I loved playing rat free.
Okay.
Because I used to scurry around as a rat on stage.
Yeah.
Everyone thought I was a weirdo.
Were you dressed in some outrageous outfit?
No, we were only in black jumpers, so we were dressed all in black and then just had rat written on us.
Okay, in case there was any doubt.
Yes.
And then I think you were in The Crucible, a different kettle of fish, a serious part. Did you have to do American accents? I can't remember.
Yes, we did. I managed to hold an American accent.
Okay.
And then halfway through, I would drop it and I wouldn't even realise.
Yes. Easily done. And you've obviously done pantomime as well. We were in the pantomime Robin Hood.
Yes.
Last year. And you were, what was your character?
I was Will Scarlet.
Will Scarlet. The goody, really, weren't you?
Yes, that's goody.
You had to whip up the audience and they had to shout something back at you about jelly. And
oh, yes. Things. I had to get them chanting about one jelly, two jelly, three jelly.
Gosh. And I think you ended up with quite a bit of jelly and ice cream on your face.
I did. Yes, so, that was quite entertaining.
Yes. Great. But I'm interested in what you've done since, really, because like Lucy, who we heard last time, you did drama at college, Exeter College. You did your A-levels last year, and you also did geography, brilliant subject. And what else did you do?
Politics.
Oh, politics. Yes. Oh, interesting too. Interesting combination. And since then, you've been a professional actor.
Oh, if that's what you call me.
Well, I do, because, I mean, let's face it, you were on the road doing a pantomime in, well, December, January.
Yes.
How many venues did you do? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know the amount of venues, but I know that we ended up doing like 42 or 43 shows.
Wow. Tell us which company was this, by the way?
This was with Hot Rocks.
Oh, right. Okay. And they're based in Exeter?
Yes, based in Exeter.
Yeah. And so did you went along and auditioned?
Yes. It was a funny story, actually. Someone told me about the audition the night before, and then I double checked with what I needed to do. I needed to learn two songs, a monologue and the dance.
Oh, right.
And I had that evening and the following morning, and I was at college. I was only managing to get to the audition because it was during a college break of mine.
Oh.
So I was quite stressed going towards it, and I've got no idea how I managed to get the role because my dance moves and singing
were you matched against other people wanting the part? Do you know?
I don't know, because when I turned up, it was like the mop-up auditions.
Yeah,
and there was only two of us there.
Ah,
so I reckon everyone else had auditioned in the first.
So it is a bit nerve-wracking, isn't it? And did they say we'll be in touch?
Yes,
and then you wait for the phone call.
Well, I got an email actually about it, and they told me through that. I was quite surprised. And then through doing that audition, I managed to land a job with them in the summertime doing children's entertainment up at Rosemore Gardens, where it's like outdoor acting. I was dressed up as a flower.
Yes, as you do. Okay, what did you have to do then? This is for children.
Yes.
And so you just passers by just flock round and you. Or is it?
Basically, so we'd set out in a tiny little field outside of the visiting centre.
Yeah.
We'd animate the space by putting some plant pots and crates around it. And then they would be told that there's a show on this time. There'll be like five shows a day, and they're only like 20 minutes short shows.
Yeah.
But they were quite fun.
Are they scripted, or did you make them up?
Oh, yes, they were scripted.
They were scripted. So how many of you acting?
There was three.
Three of you. Great. Mm-hmm. So I bet no performance was the same, though, because if you got crowds around you shouting things, I suppose.
Yeah, no. Sometimes you get the lines wrong, or some kid will shout, "It's a dragon!" And you're just like, "There's a dragon! Where's a dragon?"
And dare I ask about the weather? This was summertime, but that doesn't mean it's going to be good today.
No, did you have to cope with... We would have to move in under shelter.
Oh, you did
under
go
shelter.
Under, yeah. And was this after you did the seaside entertaining in the previous summer?
Yes, it was.
Because Lucy told us a bit about that. Did you have to do stilts?
Yes. I actually really love stilts. Ah. So, because I went up on stilts at first and terrifying, absolutely terrifying. Because I'm normally scared of heights, but my sister got rid of that because she made me jump out of a plane.
So still walking. Well parachuted.
Yes. Stilt walking was so much fun, and I managed to Spike, one of the people I was acting with, gave me a pair of springy stilts. Like these, they're only small ones. They don't get you too far off the ground, but that means I can run in them.
So how are they attached to your feet?
There was a plate that you put your foot on, and then it would be like a thing at the back that you press your, and then it would like strap around.
Oh, you do have a strap.
Yes.
I suppose you must have, isn't it? did you do it with long pair of trousers so you don't see the actual...
I couldn't fit into the pair of trousers. Okay. My waistline was too big.
Oh, really? Okay. So how much taller were you than you are normally when you got these?
At least the stilts must have doubled my height.
Really?
I reckon.
And
so.
You've got nothing to hold on to. You don't have no.
No, it's it's a balancing game.
Did you fall off?
I never fell off tall stilts. I've only ever fallen off the springy stilts, and it's quite embarrassing because I always told myself, I'm never going to fall off stilts. I'm never going to do that. And then one day when I was bored, I decided, you know, it'll be fun. Let's go on a run of the stilts and see if I'm still actually good of them.
Yeah.
And then I thought, this is a short route around a country lane. And it turned out it was way longer, and it was a 3 kilometer route that I decided to go on, which I shouldn't have done.
Yeah.
Ended up falling over during that. And I got up and,
were you with anybody?
No.
So you could have been found
just
Oh, right. That's quite interesting. So you've not been back on your stilts since?
No. Not since.
Juggling at the same time?
Oh, I can't juggle, no. Lucy was a far better juggler.
And dare I ask, Punch and Judy, were you involved with any of that?
That was somebody else's job, yes. Yeah, we would do like small little routines in front of the Punch and Judy before it happened.
I've always wanted to see what goes on inside do you call it a booth?
Yes, it's a Punch and Judy booth.
I'd love to know what's in there. There's only one operator, I suppose, is it?
Mm-hmm, yep.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. And doing the swazzle?
Yes, that's quite
an art.
Yes,
did you master it? Did you try?
No, I did not try.
Yeah, that wasn't your domain.
They have a piece of string, so I make sure that they don't choke.
You could swallow it. Yeah. Look, I want to talk a bit about your pantomime tour, going back to that. What was the arrangement? Do you all just bundle together in a minibus or something and go wherever you go? Did you go all just Devon or further afield?
Oh, we went further afield, but in regards to the car, so we had four of us staying in a Airbnb in Dawlish.
Oh, right.
And then another one was staying down on the Strand in Dawlish as well. Yeah. And so one of the people was a designated driver, and they would take the company car, which could hold like 7 or 8 people.
Yeah.
And then they would come and pick us all up and then drive to where we would meet our manager, which is the Dane. And he drove the van.
Yeah.
And then we'd all meet up at a services, and then we would all head off in the convoy type.
Where? Yeah, and what about the crew, the scenery and things? I mean, did you do that yourselves?
Yes, that was all done by the actors. And,
I assume you ended up in all kinds of sort of village halls and
whatever.
Some probably not kitted up for and lighting and everything. And then and then you have to get out at a certain time and while the caretaker or somebody's
There was multiple times when we were in a school and they'd be standing there with the tables ready for the kids' lunches, waiting for us to go. And we're just like, we're going as fast as we can.
Yeah. It sounds glamorous, doesn't it, in theory?
Yes.
Touring,
grand tour. And then you get to
it's not at all, is it?
It's a lot of fun, though.
Yeah, I'm sure. Any particular memories? Anything either went wrong or, you know, a particular place or... you didn't have to have the dreaded theatre landladies. So you didn't. There are lots of stories that people tell about those. But yeah, anything that sticks in your mind of either, or was it? Did it all go smoothly?
Oh, no, far from smoothly. But that was what made it so fun. I distinctly remember it. It's when we're trying to get out of trouble with Flesh Creep, which is a bad guy.
Yeah.
I say, my mum is a fantastic opera singer. That's what I normally said.
Yes.
However, sometimes when I wanted to stitch up the dame because they stitched me up in a par scene,
oh, really?
I would make it up. I would either say like they're a break dancer or
it puts one on the spot a bit, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It's hilarious.
So, as long as you all got on, you had a good sort of team.
No, everyone got on very well. Right. Yeah.
So you do it again.
Oh, yes, I do.
Yes. Would you have to audition again?
Yeah, I reckon so. I'd have to do audition.
Do they just do pantos or other shows during the year?
They're quite involved with Creeley at the moment. Mm. And I know that they are doing like this pirate hunt thing during Easter times at Creeley. And then during Halloween, I was at their Halloween event last year, which was Treehouse Trolls.
And were you a character?
I was a troll and a woodlander, actually. Because I used to put people on breaks and swap between the characters so I could allow the trolls to go on break after the woodlanders had gone on break.
Did you make anyone cry?
Yes. Oh, that as a troll, it was the most fun making the kids cry because I know it sounds really horrible.
It does. We'll get letters.
Because I used to jump scare them a bit too much.
I see.
I just got too lost in the character.
Well, that's all right. That's fine. What character were you in the pantomime, by the way? Were you Jack?
Yes, I was Jack. Yes.
So you did. Did you have to climb a beanstalk, or is it all done with effects?
We had an inflatable beanstalk.
Oh, right.
Which was quite.
I had to blow that up.
Yes, we had to turn on this.
It had a special machine.
Yes,
had
to turn on machine.
What fun!
Yes,
right. Okay.
It's quite difficult to set up in smaller venues, sometimes it will pop up at a random location. But yes.
And was there a cow?
There was a cow. Yes, the fairy would have to get out the fairy costume and then put on this cow suit, and the entire audience loved the cow so much because you got introduced to the cow Daisy through like some dance music, and it was just like. They love Daisy.
Fantastic. And did you have to sing a solo?
No. Thank the Lord.
This is not
is not my strongest point.
well, perhaps, you know, listen in a moment to what you might want to choose to finish with. Who knows where your future performances will take you, Josh?
Who knows?
We wish you well with your theatrical career and all else. Maybe when you've conquered Hollywood, do pop back and tell us about your next chapter.
Of course.
In the meantime, we invite you to choose a recording, piece of music, on which to finish. So what might it be? And I wonder why you've chosen it.
I'm going to pick Daydream Believer by the Monkees.
Yes.
And this is because it was one of the first panto songs that I sung on a stage.
Yeah.
And I actually quite enjoyed singing that song. It was the one song that I felt like, oh, you know what? I can actually read that note.
And you could do it.
Yeah.
And I seem to remember the audience swaying along, waving their arms and just enjoying it.
Yeah, no, me and the princess, we know. Oh, it wasn't the princess. Oh, I totally got that wrong. It was the other lady character. I can't remember her name.
Don't ask me. Was she a fairy?
No. It was like the princess's best friend.
Yes, and, of course.
We would just stand on stage holding hands, and then just as the music was set in, then we would start bouncing along as we've been sat there still.
It was great. So, thank you, Josh. It's been very entertaining and interesting listening to you, and all the best with your next adventure.
Thank you very much.
And meanwhile, I'll hand over to the Monkees.
Hey.
I could hide 'neath the wings of the bluebird as she sings. The 6 o'clock alarm would never ring, but it rings and I rise, wipe the sleep out of my eyes. My shaven razor's cold and it stings. Night on on his steed. Now you know how happy I can be. Oh, and our good time starts and ends without dollar one to spend. But how much, baby, do we really need? Cheer up, sleepy Jean. Oh, what can it mean to a daydream believer and a homecoming queen? Cheer up, sleepy Jean. Oh, what can it mean to a daydream believer and a homecoming queen? Cheer up, sleepy Jean. Oh, what can it mean to a daydream believer and a homecoming queen? Cheer up, sleepy Jean. Oh, what can it mean to a daydream believer and a homecoming queen?
That song was Daydream Believer by the Monkees. It's over to David Picton.
This is a poem about families and family ties. It's a sonnet in praise of families. Family ties are but one of a kind, an unquestioned kindness wrapped around kin. Not chains interlocked, but love intertwined, and which we share through our lives, thick and thin. They're stronger than steel and softer than silk. They're links interwove and forged from our clay. They're ties that are set with mother's first milk, that we cherish, whether home or away. Families are grown through the seeds that are sown, and are nourished by the love they are fed. They sail through rough seas wherever they're blown, and are strengthened with each step that we tread. So let's raise a glass and offer reply to our families and the loved ones they tie.
You could say this was a belated poem for Mothering Sunday. However, it is extra special because it encompasses the whole family. We now have Sue Smallwood with her story.
This piece was inspired by a visit to the House of Marbles. I ambled through the dimly lit museum exhibits and was immediately assailed by a low-pitched, powerful roar, causing me to falter in the doorway as I tried to gather my senses. As I stood there, the roar dimmed briefly, like a dragon taking a deep breath before giving vent to his fury once more by opening his mouth wide and belching forth the flames to deter trespassers from entering his domain. Surprised, I looked back at the exhibits and my fellow visitors, chattering to one another, as they admired the skillfully lit contents of the display cases. Only then did I glance up at the sign above my head. There was no warning of the danger to come, but a notice declaring that the glassblowers were at work today. My heels clicked as I walked across the tiled floor, drawn forward by the noise and the heat, and eager to watch these masters of their craft at work. I stood fascinated as tools on their long handles were selected and lifted from their metal resting place, leaving the metal reverberating dully on the concrete. A furnished door was opened, noiselessly, I think, but any sound was overwhelmed by the roar of the red-hot fire within, and even at a distance I could feel the heat rushing out. Nearby, hot tools, their use fulfilled, were plunged into water with a great hissing and a burst of steam. I tried to work my way closer to the front of the watching crowd, muttering, "Excuse me," as I moved through the whispering, rustling layers of outdoor clothing, and catching snippets of admiring conversation from those onlookers exiting the workshop. Unable to find a place to stand at the front, I continued to rustle my way through the crowd towards the mezzanine steps. The metal clanked faintly as I walked up the steps, and my ring clinked delicately and rhythmically against the handrail as I made my way towards the top for a bird's eye view.
Let's find out from Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor about the book that they have been reading recently.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I have been looking at Maureen Fry and the Angel of the North by Rachel Joyce. This is the third in a trilogy, but actually it stands wonderfully on its own as a picture of grief and insulation and a kind of loneliness. But it's so redeeming. It's so well worth having a listen to. It's just wonderful. It's such a visually written book that you can, in your mind's eye, you can see the drive. You can see her interaction with the people she sees on her drive. You can see the garden. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, so I think we just need to explain a little bit about the backstory here. So this is the third book that Rachel Joyce has written about the same characters, although each book focuses on a different character. So the first one was The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. That's Maureen's husband. And that's this best-selling book of about 12 years ago, where he walks from Kingsbridge in Devon all the way up to Gateshead, I think it is, up in the north of Northumbria. He walks the whole distance, becomes a kind of minor celebrity on the way, and he's going to meet this former colleague of his called Queenie Hennessy, who has, I think, really been in love with him for years, and they've kind of never really, nothing really came of it, but they were close colleagues. And then the second one is about Queenie Hennessy waiting for him to arrive. So that book we did last year, Mary and I. And then this one is set 10 years later, and it's during the COVID time, I think. And it's about Maureen Fry, who's the wife Harold left behind when he did the walk. And it's, I think, actually helpful to read the first two before you read this
I agree.
Because you then understand about the situation with their son, who's committed suicide in the past. And that's the source of the plot for this one, really, why she's going up in the car. She doesn't walk. So I would recommend, if you've got the time, to listen to all three. They're all fantastic. But this one is, I think, it means
lovely.
More to
it
you.
It does, yes. Yeah. And also the incident of the son wasn't mentioned in the first story until quite well in, and it was by intimation more than in explanation. And this one, again, looks at it from Maureen's point of view as the broken-hearted mother of her only child. But it is, for her, a journey of learning more about her son, her envy of the possibility that another woman was close to him. She will never know. We know, she will never know. But it is the personal things relating to Maureen on this journey, her opening up to other ways, to other people, to friendliness, which she's naturally an open and friendly person. And she actually makes a serious effort to be open and friendly. And that, I think, that opening of her personality and her understanding of her son, and in the end of her husband, who she's totally devoted to all the way through. She's never wavered. She just doesn't understand him at all.
What I found interesting is at the start, she's not a very nice character. Well, at least she doesn't appear to be. She's forever having rows with waitresses and intolerant of things and impatient. And of course, we get to understand as the book goes on why this is. And it's true, she does, I think, move on, doesn't she? There's a sort of reckoning with her past and let's move on. She's extremely moving. The end is beautiful.
It is. It really is. And also, even getting to the garden in the end, she doesn't realise the meaning of it. She can't understand that it's a garden. And I think the fact that she went to it in the dark as well was eye-opening in a sense to her. But yes, the realisation and of the discoveries in that garden and of part of herself, that's what made it wonderful and moving.
And there are, but it's also quite funny. I mean, but all three of the books are deeply moving and beautifully, sensitively written, but there are light moments. And in her case, it's her kind of clash with a different kind of cultures that she comes up against.
Yes.
And it satirises modern life, contemporary life, a little bit about lockdown and so on, which makes it not just one long, miserable read by any means.
It isn't at all.
It's an uplifting
read. Yes. Yes, indeed.
Mary and Stephen have just reviewed the book Maureen Fry and the Angel of the North by Rachel Joyce. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and as a downloadable audiobook. Here is Ninon Jerome with her story entitled Silver Swans.
This is another short story in the adventurous life of Violet Pettigrew, and it's called Silver Swans. Violet was cold, and she was sitting indoors. How much longer now before she could turn on the heating? 5 hours. She didn't think she could last that long. Come on, Violet, think. She wasn't a Pettigrew for nothing. Her grandfather had fought on the Somme. Her grandmother had been a suffragette. Parents respected teachers, and her mother had been on the Aldermaston March whilst pregnant with her. She was from proud stock and made of sterner stuff than giving in to the cold. Violet put on another jumper. She was wearing 5 now. Perhaps some calisthenics might help. Violet began gamely jumping up and down. She began swinging her arms like windmills, carefully avoiding the ornaments on the mantelpiece. Her cat, Miss Marple, gazed on with a seeming mixture of alarm and amusement. A film of perspiration gathered on Violet's brow. She was beginning to get out of breath. Goodness, she needed to do more exercise. She sat down with relief, and then began to feel cold again. This would not do at all. She would go for a brisk walk instead. And so she squeezed her woolen coat over her curves and 5 jumpers. The buttons wouldn't quite do up, but this would have to do. And grabbing her keys, out she went. She walked briskly around the Strand, swinging her arms as far as she could in her tight coat. She found herself passing the library. She popped in. It was deliciously warm inside, and Violet struggled out of her coat and 3 of the 5 jumpers. She helped herself to a coffee and sat with a sigh, wiggling her toes and enjoying the return of some sensation in them. She looked about her and spotted a notice board. On it, a poster caught her eye. Silver Swans, ballet class for over 50s. Free first class! She would go. It would be a perfect way to keep warm, and you never know, she might enjoy it. As a young child, Violet had danced and twirled, imagining herself as a prima ballerina. except when she tried to pirouette in the living room, the vibrations as she landed had brought down Mother's precious Meissen figurine. She was not allowed to dance again. Violet could do so now without anyone stopping her. And so she had found a faded Spandau ballet t-shirt and leg warmers, and off she went. The village hall was large and cold. The wall heaters barely dented the cold, but there were 10 other ladies there of a certain age, much like Violet. They moved to the bar as one. The teacher played The Dying Swan from Swan Lake, and they began. In her head, Violet imagined herself on stage at Covent Garden, with good joints and feathers like arms. Violet became lost in her imagination. She was cold no longer.
Gosh, Ninon's story does remind us that it has been a long and cold winter, doesn't it? And keeping active does help keep the chill away. We now have Fran Frank with her Where in Devon? Location clues and answers.
Hello again. Here is another of my Where in Devon articles. The area is not very far away from a location that I mentioned in a previous recording, and probably has just as much history. So here are a few facts for you to ponder on before I confirm where this month's location is. The main town is situated on the side of a well-known river. It has a harbour, but this can only be accessed by very small vessels. The town is served by a railway, but it is not operated by South Western Railways or GWR. Two vehicle ferries and two passenger ferries operate regularly in and around the river. The estuary is guarded by two castles built to protect the town from invasion. A local cove dating from the 16th century has been used in at least one major television programme. And finally, there is a famous educational establishment perched high on the hill, looking out towards the sea. Did any of the clues give the destination away? It is, of course, Dartmouth, located at the mouth of the River Dart. The harbour that I mentioned is located in the middle of the town and can only be accessed by rowing boats or very small yachts, as they have to enter via a tunnel that runs under the main road. Most vessels visiting Dartmouth, including some very large cruise ships nowadays, moor up in the middle of the river. The railway line is operated by the South Devon Steam Company, which runs between Paignton and Kingswear. There is actually a railway station located on the Dartmouth side of the river that was built in 1889, but for some reason no railway line was ever constructed on that side of the valley, and although they left the building in place, it has never been used for passengers. Due to the fact that a lot of people approach Dartmouth from Tor Bay, as well as from the South Hams side, there has always been the need for ferries. The upper ferry and the lower ferry both take vehicles as well as foot passengers, but they are operated in different ways. One of them is propelled or pushed by a tug-style boat that manoeuvres a flat platform from one side of the river to the other, whereas the second ferry uses its own engines to pull the platform along by means of a chain which links both shores. As you can gather, I am no engineer, but hopefully you'll understand what I mean. In addition to these larger ferries, there is also a passenger ferry linking the Kingswear railway station with Dartmouth Quayside, and in the summer months there is also a small passenger carrying boat operated between the Quayside and Dartmouth Castle. The castle at Dartmouth was built in 1388 and is now run as a tourist attraction by English Heritage. Kingswear Castle, sitting on the opposite side of the estuary, was constructed in 1502 and is now used as a private home. The local cove is of course Bayard's Cove, which appeared in the Oneidin line during the 1970s. Most of us would probably recognise the theme tune for the programme, but whether we actually remember where it was filmed is another thing. Some people think that parts of the Titanic film were also filmed in and around Bayard's Cove, but it was in fact Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, and not Dartmouth, Devon. The imposing building looking out over the town is of course Britannia Naval College, which was built in 1905. It was also where Queen Elizabeth, then Princess Elizabeth, first met Prince Philip. Well done if you guessed the location. I hope you enjoyed hearing a few facts about another of our historic towns here in Devon. Bye!
Here is Norma Orty with her story entitled Dream Books.
It was January, my miserable month, cold and dark and wet. But I left the travel agents feeling happy and full of anticipation. I manoeuvred through the crowds of scurrying shoppers who splashed through the puddles in my path. It had been raining for almost a week. Much needed rain, but enough was enough. This was often the way with the weather, too much or too little. Arriving home, I let myself in and was soon comfortable with a cup of Earl Grey beside me. After a cursory glance at the ever-depressing news, I switched off the TV and turned to my booty from the travel agents. The young assistant had been busy with clients and told me to help myself, so I did. I fanned out the brochures on the table before me. Brilliant colours illuminated the room. Seas of bright blue, red-robed buildings, pyramids in shades of earthy brown and vegetation in a myriad tones of green. I lifted the first brochure. Where would it take me? Oh, the Mediterranean. In alphabetical order, the countries were listed. Croatia, Cyprus, Greece, Italy, Malta, Spain and Turkey. Where to go first? I felt as if I had been presented with a box of expensive chocolates, each country more enticing than the rest for the next. I studied the map inside the cover. Starting in the west, I made a visit to Portugal. I would need a visa, but English is spoken in tourist areas. The photos that were shown were not unlike home. Lots of golf courses. I travelled on to Spain. The climate of the Med was preferable to that of other parts. Visits to cities were often on offer, and to resorts, but I just knew that they would be overrun by the British, loud, red-faced and soccer-mad. I paged on until I found Italy. That looked more interesting. I studied photos and itineraries. Away from the main centres there were many choices. One could walk the Tuscan hills, everything arranged and luggage transferred to the next accommodation. Cooking classes could also be taken. Stay in Mariangela's guest house. Go with her to the quaint market and buy fresh produce for your lesson, and then cook and eat the regional speciality, clever Maria Angela. I looked briefly at Malta, the Greek Isles and Cyprus. It necessitated a lot of boarding and departing on time. Not my idea of a restful holiday. Although the photos were most enticing. White cruise ships with rows of sunbeds on deck facing a blue, blue sea. I turned a page and found kayak and hiking in Crete. 8 days of the most energetic activity. In 8 days it was possible to circle the island. Basic instruction was given on day one, and lashings of embrocation, I hoped. Croatia looked ideal. Crystal ocean and beaches with bronzed beauties. Cruises, island hopping and cycle tours. Strangely, I found the sun blinding. Maybe I should look to Northern Europe. The next glossy book promoted Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland and Svalbard. Svalbard? I found the page and was transported from heat to cold, from sun to snow. I read that Spitsbergen is a Norwegian island, part of the Svalbard archipelago, 60% covered in glaciers and snowfields, 40% in jagged peaks. And yet I read the tiny capital of Longyearbyen, which is at 78 degrees north, is warmed by the Gulf Stream, with a summer average of 6 degrees. Being above the Arctic Circle, it benefits from the midnight sun. Since there are no roads, guests fly in and then transfer a ship. 3,000 polar bears, 110 types of migrating birds, reindeer, walrus, seal, Arctic fox, and whales are what they want to see. Just 80 kilometres from the North Pole. Fascinating information, but it made me feel cold. I was studying a photo of the magnificent Hvergefjarðar Fjord when my wife called me. Are you ready for supper? I put aside the dream books and sang out, Coming, love, and carefully trundled my wheelchair into the dining room.
I bet Norma's story got you thinking about taking a holiday to sunnier and warmer climes. It is Dame Kiwite Kanawa's 80th birthday this month. To mark this occasion, we have selected her singing Giacomo Puccini's O Mio Babbino Caro from his opera Gianni Schicchi. It is sung by the character Lauretta to her father about her love for Rinuccio. Like me, if you're not familiar with the Italian language, then the following is the literal translation of Puccini's O Mio Babbino Caro. It goes as follows. Oh, my dear papa, I love him. He is handsome, handsome. I want to go to Porta Rossa to buy the ring. Yes, yes, I want to go there. And if I loved him in vain, I would go to the Ponte Vecchio, but to throw myself in the Arno. I am anguished and tormented. O God, I'd want to die. Papa, have pity, have pity. Papa, have pity, have pity. It doesn't sound so spectacular read out by me in English, does it? As many opera lovers would say, you don't have to understand the language to appreciate opera. Let's sit back and enjoy Dame Kiwite Kanawa performing with the London Philharmonic Orchestra.
Mi piace bello mio.
Our thanks go to John Townsend and his guest Josh Meredith, David Picton, Sue Smallwood, Mary MacDonald, Stephen Taylor, Ninon Jerome, Fran Frank and Norma Orty. Thanks also to Diana Coulson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and dispatching the USB sticks, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor and Mike Smith.